This is the Saxo Market Call, daily insights on what is moving the financial markets.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Friday, 10th of September, 2021. We have a lot going on in markets, a lot to get through today, so I'll keep the little intro bit brief here. We saw a little bit of a defensive session in the U.S. yesterday, markets closing, equity market in the U.S. closing sort of on a low note after trying to rally in the wake of a quite dovish ECB. And then we had sentiment back up overnight on news that Xi Jinping and U.S. President Biden were in a long phone conversation, apparently initiated by President Biden in frustration over the lack of progress in these previous attempts at talks by lower level officials. There was a bit of spin on what came out of the call, but it sounded like it was an attempt to reestablish the relationship. The market took it as a positive, but we still see this momentum divergence set up in something like the NASDAQ 100. As you can see, we've certainly lost momentum to the upside over the last several days. So interesting to see whether we're rolling over something like what we saw back in April, May for a little correction there, or whether we can sort of find a support at this quite shallow dip we've seen thus far. I don't know if you want to pull much more out of the yesterday's session. It wasn't particularly volatile, Peter, but I think it's more interesting what happened in rates yesterday. But I'll let you do a brief wrap.
Yeah, we are in quite a mixed situation. And with these flat momentum has have waned or eased quite substantially. It was a good rebound session in Asia across all the markets. So that was okay. I don't know what the actual trigger was for that. I think the rebound was also evident in U.S. equity futures. Anyway, we're bouncing back a little bit. We are flat, and as you can see, there is no clear direction across the different themes, maybe except for gaming. I think we mentioned that yesterday on the podcast, but at least we can mention it here again, that China is really clamping hard down on the gaming industry. They are now banning any new approval of new games in China. So it's just a complete halt there. And you know, they're using these phrases that Tencent, for instance, and other gaming developers should stop focusing on profit. So it's a very challenging environment to be an investor in Chinese equities. And I'll come back to that because I think India is on the flip side of that trade. So, but that's later in the podcast.
All right, let's have a look at the ECB meeting yesterday. It was definitely a snoozer. We had a bit of anticipation, and I included myself in that among those that were looking for a potentially more hawkish outturn. I think yesterday, though, before the meeting, I was sort of expressed that I think I'd probably gotten a bit over my head on that account and was pulling back a bit. And that proved to be the correct decision because it was a very boring meeting that did carry off a so-called taper by agreeing to a moderately slower pace of purchases. Doesn't really matter anyway. Issuance slows down in Q4. They had already pre-announced they were going to be doing our so-called front loading of purchases earlier in the year. And really nothing in the press conference, which is just excruciating to listen to Ms. Lagarde speak, I'm sorry to say. The most interesting thing in the projections we saw, we did see the 2021 forecast raised quite significantly for both inflation and real GDP, as you can see on slide three. A slight rise to the and it's slightly lowered for GDP in 2022, but then the 1.7% is a little bit interesting for 2022, the CPI forecast, and then the 2023 only raised by 0.1%. So obviously, the ECB also buying into the transitory inflation narrative. And then we have on the U.S. Treasury yield side and bunds, so finding this to be a bit of a relief. We see quite a rally in German bunds and U.S. Treasuries, as you can see on slide four. U.S. Treasury, 10-year Treasury on the left. We had another strong auction, this time of the 30-year T-bond in the U.S. And we see that this entire sort of interesting episode we saw where we were looking for a potential upside breakout in yields, it completely reversed here, at least locally and tactically. So that's just completely off the table now and driving our yields lower. And in effects, and I'll round out my space because we got a lot to get through in commodities and equities. The most interesting thing to me, besides lower yields that helps the yen out, help the Swiss out a little bit, is the Chinese renminbi, which got activated a little bit by this Biden-Xi call. And you could look for, and we're seeing a little bit of independent movement on the part of the CNY. Keep an eye on euro renminbi as well. So euro versus the Chinese yuan, because we're about 1% away from a massive level that goes back to pre-pandemic era. So I think that would be a key signal that the renminbi is doing something beyond simply trading a little bit directionally against whatever the dollar is doing. In other words, going from low beta to something independent But it'll of course be up to Chinese policymakers what they want to do with their currency more than or as much as market forces. All right, Ola, I want to jump to you really quickly because there was another thing interesting yesterday in terms of signaling, in terms of market activity, and that was at least the headline that China was talking about releasing barrels from their strategic reserves into the market. We saw the market a little bit all over the place. What's going on there?
Yeah, it was, as I said here on the right here on slide 7, it was a roller coaster day in oil markets. We trade up and down within the $2 range, and the news flow was very mixed. But the one that really caught the attention was, as you say, John, the headline basically saying from the National Food and Strategic Reserves Administration in China that they had released oil reserves from their giant reserves to stem the price of raw materials. It later turned out that this was actually just a rehash of a news that an action that already took place back in July. So with that in mind, the impact tapered off somewhat. So Brent crude for now stays above that 21-day moving average, as you can see on the chart there. But I think the even though it's old news, it's still significant because US and China have both voiced their concerns about high oil prices recently. They both hold the biggest stockpiles of crude oil in the world. And that means if we could indicate that the price is much above current levels, so above 75 on Brent, is a level that they feel uncomfortable with. And so there's just a warning to the market that additional releases could be coming if prices move up again. But just rounding up the oil market, we also had the weekly EIA report, and it was just all over the place because it showed the impact of Hurricane Ida, and a hurricane which is still impacting the crude oil production, which is still down by around 70-75%. In the Gulf, so it is impacting these numbers. As you can see, some big drops in crude oil production, down 1.5 million barrels on the week. In refinery demand, down by 1.6 million barrels. Gasoline inventories tanking because refineries are not producing, and crude oil inventories drifting lower as well. So all in all, a supportive report, but obviously very distorted.
All right, and then we saw that $5 gas we talked about, which is basically the highest level we've seen in the U.S. at least, and of course much higher elsewhere. I believe I looked at the chart this morning back in 2014. These are getting to be some very
absolutely
heavy prices.
We could talk gas in a separate full webinar because gas price is just ridiculous. What we're seeing in Europe right now is it's been going on for months now, but it's really now only now during the past couple of weeks it's reached the main press, mainstream press, and it is a serious problem because we got gas price in Europe trading at the equivalent of something like $105 Brent. We've got record prices as well in Asia. We've got coal prices surging higher, emission costs surging higher, and all our power bills, utility bills, are going to skyrocket this winter. And there is a real worry that if we do get another very cold winter, we could run into supply constraints. So industry perhaps are being forced to cut production. We can't turn down the heat. I suppose we can, but it was one corner of the market we definitely need to keep a very close eye on.
All right, we'll have to do that. One area you're looking at, Peter, in terms of geographies, is India, and you've got some thoughts here on slide 6. Take us through why you're focusing on India.
Yeah, I have. We've been talking about India for some time now, and I've mentioned it a couple of times as you know, one of the markets to really look out for the next 10 years. I think I've said it before, I'll reiterate it. India sits, I think, in a very sweet spot with the US-China tensions still continuing to be very prevalent and continuing. And India will sit very nicely in the geopolitical alliance, I think, between the US, South Korea, Japan, and Australia, to some extent New Zealand. And then also we have all these supply constraints coming out of China, which I think that we will still continue to see a large part of the world's production being manufactured in China for good reasons. They are very cost competitive. They have good infrastructure, etc. But I think it has dawned on a lot of companies that you cannot have too much of your production in one country, despite how attractive it is on price and infrastructure. So I think India increasingly will play a role in that reconfiguration of the global supply chains. They are seeing a very positive mood in the capital markets, and that's despite obviously a Q2 here in 2021 because of the COVID-19 wave that saw it, a hit to the GDP. But the expectations are still that GDP growth will be quite solid here in 2021. And then there's this news that SoftBank has invested 4 times more in India this year than in China. And obviously, there's a technology crackdown, I would say, on the broader private sector in China going on that increases the regulatory uncertainty. And it's not that I think that SoftBank is a high quality marker necessarily, but I think they are part of an ecosystem. So if they are investing 4 times more in India, other private equity groups and large technology investors are likely doing the same thing. And there is a rapid pace right now going on in Indian IPOs, mirroring a little bit what we're seeing in the US. I think there's 150 new IPOs in the US pending. So I just think, and then you can see here on the chart on slide 6, you can see this is a relative performance chart between MSCI India versus China. So you can see India's relative performance to India over the past 18, 19 months has been staggering. I mean, it's around 50%. So I think we are looking at the early innings of a major shift here.
All right, and then you're hopping over to this ongoing story with no end in sight, the semiconductor shortage. There was a news item you made us aware of this morning about Toyota. I guess their production estimates for 300,000 fewer vehicles this year. And you've got some more stuff for us here on slide 9 talking about the palladium and platinum. Although yeah. That's for you, Ola. I'm sorry.
Indeed. Well, it is linked into what Peter's looking at as well. The semiconductor shortage has been a key theme for several months now, and we're starting to see the impact because as car producers around the world, they struggle to meet their orders and their production quotas. Then that triggers also reduction in demand for pollution. What do you call them?
Catalytic converters in cars.
Exactly, yeah. That's the word. And palladium is a key component there. And we've seen since it hit a record high above $3,000 an ounce back in May, it's basically collapsed by almost 30%. Yesterday, it dropped to a 12-month low. And it is a combination of not only the first of all, that the high price is a cure for high price. So the high price back in May has led to manufacturers, automobile manufacturers switching back to palladium, to platinum, at the expense of palladium. So that's reducing demand. And now also with the overall slowdown in demand sinking both. And just putting in as well platinum here on slide 9, you can see that we normally tend to just watch it as a spread against gold. And that spread is back above $1,800. It hit a peak of more than $1,000 late last year, but it has been moving up quite a bit recently. So it's one, I think, it's probably a recovery candidate worth keeping an eye on, more so than palladium.
All right. Do you want to round out? Let's go ahead and round out the commodity space, and then we'll get back to Peter on ESG, which I think is a massive area that we're going to be looking at.
Yeah, just fine. We got a monthly supply and demand report on tap now from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The market is pricing in an improvement in the late season weather, supporting crops, corn and soybean production. And that basically means that the market is looking for an increase in both production and thereby also stocks in today's report. And the market has responded accordingly, been coming down. So I just put in the one of the grains ETFs, tracking the Bloomberg Commodity Grains Index. And as you can see, we are at some pretty critical support levels here.
Okay, dope. Have to watch for that. Unfortunately, the food price part of inflation seems to be in abeyance at the moment. So we've talked a lot about internally, Peter, this whole push towards ESG, to what degree it's in some cases virtue signaling and just making sure you have a message as much as it is transformation of businesses. But what's your intent here with this slide 10? We have looking at ESG and in regards to the MSCI world, et cetera.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a commercial or advertisement for our for a piece on ESG yesterday, which you can find on the analysis.saxo. And we're rolling out more content on ESG. We will be providing all the different funds that you could invest in on the Saxo platform. And we have a new head of ESG, which will also provide more information on ESG. But I wrote this because it has been part of the narrative on ESG that it creates outperformance by doing, investing in these companies that have a better profile on the environmental impact and the social and the governance side. And I'll try to keep it very brief. So when you look at the when you compare the MSCI World ESG Enhanced Index, which is the dark blue line here on slide 10, and you compare it to the normal MSCI World Index, you can see that the majority of the outperformance, which is very small, is only 40 basis point annualized. Then you see the majority of that outperformance have come since the bottom from during the start of the pandemic last year. And that happens to coincide with ESG having lower weight on technology companies, and technology companies have outperformed. So the question we're asking, is it a ripple or is it a wave? And we don't think the outperformance of the wave is more a ripple. It is a hygiene factor for a lot of investors, especially pension funds, because there are a lot of narrative and also values within the population that have changed over the past 10 years. And they want to not, be sure or safe that they don't own stocks in tobacco and military companies, etc. A final thing I want to mention as well is that a lot of these technology companies are scoring high. I've put in a snapshot here from the Bloomberg's ESG rating, and we have two issues with it. So a lot of these ESG ratings are all over the place. They're never the same, and that's because they weight different metrics differently, and they're also looking at things differently. But I would say two things from what you can see in the screenshot is one of the things that they weight on the environmental side is their greenhouse gases to revenue. But we know that large companies have economics of scales, scale over smaller companies. So larger companies have a positive bias in these ESG metrics because they have, you know, they can do more revenue on their impact. And then the final thing is, which I think is a direct attack from my side on the technologies being overweight, is that they always score high ratings, but can you really measure the full impact across the entire supply chain for a company like Tesla? That's one question. The second one is that on the governance side, look at the metrics that Bloomberg is using here. They're not even looking at the dual share class listings of a company like Alphabet or Facebook, which essentially are putting the entire power of a major company into the hands of very few people. I don't think you should score high on governance when you basically are a king in your own little kingdom and cannot be, you know, exerted from external pressures. So, but read the entire article. I think there's a lot of good perspective on ESG. And I do also think it has value in this world. It's not for me to be overly critical, but I think in terms of performance, I don't think that's the reason why you should do ESG investing. It's more for your own conscience that you do ESG, not for the performance.
Well, you bring up some important points in that the metrics are very difficult to sort of, you know, put up on a list or a spreadsheet and weight, and there's just all different kinds of things. And there are certain things that are greenhouse gas intensive that we need no matter what, but you could maybe do it less intensely than the next company. There are all different kinds of ways to approach that issue. Then on earnings, we have this Zscaler again in today's highlights. What's your focus here?
Yeah, but it was because we highlighted them yesterday and they reported after the close. I just wanted to follow up because one of our equity themes is, you know, on cybersecurity. And I think it's a very fascinating industry because it's defensive. It's something you must have as a company in today. So I think it will have a very low correlation to the business cycle. And then it's high growth industry above 10% on average growth rates on the top line. And Zscaler is a cloud-based one and growing very fast, as you can see. And they're growing at more than 50% on the top line. And they put out an outlook for the current quarter they're in, which was better than expected on the revenue. And they're expecting to post their first annual profit for the fiscal quarter 2022, which ends in July next year. And the share price reaction was positive. And as you can see, it's a company with very strong momentum, although you are paying an extremely high price. And then today, the only major stock to have on your radar in terms of earnings is Oracle. I've put in a little preview here from Bloomberg, and it's just, maybe it's even, I would say it's more fun to watch paint dry than watching Oracle earnings, because they've lost out on so many of the high growth technologies in recent years. And it's just a company that grows around 1-4% on the top line. And it's all about just managing your cost. I find it to be an extremely boring company.
Maybe the CEO is too busy pursuing his extracurricular activities and sailing and so on. That could be, that could be part of it. Let's have a look at the macro calendar for today. A couple of interesting points to bring out. Certainly not one of them being ECB President Lagarde speaking, but the Russian Central Bank and the guidance there, as we're getting a bit closer to the point where we wonder if the speed of rate hikes is going to continue. They're expected to hike rates 50 basis points to take the rate to 7% after the August CPI in Russia hit 6.7% year on year. And that's despite a pretty stable ruble, which has generally been behind, big ruble moves have generally been behind a lot of the CPI pressures in the past. So, and the same time, this is applying the screws a bit to the economy. But guidance will be interesting there. Dollar ruble has been under pressure, so let's see what happens. And then on the August PPI out of the U.S., very interesting. These levels are just incredible. Looking at 0.6% month-on-month expectations for both the core and the headline after the 1% print for both of these, actually, in July. And then on the year-on-year, looking at 6.6% for the core versus 6.2% in July and 8.2% on the headline versus 7.8% for July. So not quite as high as the Chinese PPI, which was at 9.5% yesterday, but still very high levels. And this, again, the stakes in this whole transitory or not are very high. And then we'll do a more thorough coverage of next week's economic calendar on Monday, but just want to highlight there are a couple of interesting U.S. data points next week, including the August CPI. Retail sales, I'm really curious about that one in August with the Delta variant, et cetera, getting even more interesting in September and October as some of these benefits have rolled off to see what spending levels do there, as well as what happens with the the huge number of job openings and whether some of those jobs are getting taken by people that are no longer receiving pandemic benefits. That will be evident in the September and October data cycles. For now, that's a wrap. Have a great weekend out there. Stay careful, and we'll be back next week with the Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter @SaxoMarketCall or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.